By all accounts, the nation is on an unsustainable fiscal course. Congress's own budget and oversight agencies say this regularly, yet members refuse to confront the main drivers of exploding deficits. There's got to be another way. Elaine Kamark is a veteran of budget battles as a member of the Clinton administration. She's now with the Brookings Institution, and she joined Federal News Network's Tom Temin earlier to talk about what can be done.
As you point out in your latest piece at Brookings, what they end up arguing about on the Hill is a fraction of the budget, because after interest on the debt, after the entitlement programs, which are ruled quote-unquote non-discretionary, there's the defense budget and there's the rest of the operating, the government budget. One side won't commit to cutting the opposite side and vice versa, and so they keep approving these big budgets. What can possibly break this jam and maybe get to some of the big issues?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. There's just no money to speak of in the non-defense discretionary side of the budget. And the problem with that, of course, is that even what is in the non-defense discretionary side is things that people think are important. And as I said in my piece, you know, the air traffic controllers. People get pretty mad when they can't take off on time or flights are canceled because there aren't enough controllers to fly safely. So there's a lot in that piece of the budget that's hard to cut. Look, there are only two ways to do this. Let's just talk about that. The first way is to decide that you're not going to do this function at the federal level anymore. Okay, take an entire department, take Housing and Urban Development. People have argued that HUD is essentially a local and regional issue, not a national issue. And okay, so maybe we shouldn't have a housing policy at the national level. Okay, if you say we're not going to do this anymore, and states will do it, or cities will do it, or regional entities will do it, okay, that's one way to cut the federal budget. But to simply take money out so that what the federal government is left doing, they're doing badly, is pretty stupid, right? So that's one way. The second way is the way we did it in the Clinton administration in reinventing government, which was very time consuming, very people heavy, although we didn't hire people. We got people from the agencies to do it who came over to work for us, is to actually look agency by agency. What are they doing? What could be automated? Where could layers of management be cut because you were going to use technology, et cetera? And we did cut the workforce. Bill Clinton did have a balanced budget by the end of his term, second term. And that is another way to do it. But that is anathema to the Republicans. They hate government so much they don't want to learn about it.
Well, on the other hand, you could say Democrats love it so much they can't give up one fingernail shaving of it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, both parties have real problems with this, right? Democrats think everything is sacrosanct. Republicans don't want anything. And frankly, if you want to cut the budget, you have to really learn about the federal government. You have to really take a hard look at what they're doing and how they're doing it. It can be done, but it is really not easy.
The bigger questions, the discretionary budget is roughly a little bit north of $1.5 trillion. Maybe it's approaching 1.6 in the 2024 request. And if you could take $100 billion out of it, $200 billion out of it, it would not make a dent really in the deficit, because there's another $4.5 trillion that nobody will touch. Well, you can't touch the interest, the debt service, because then that would be defaulting on the debt. But then there is entitlement, which again is a third rail. And I'm just looking at France, which realized that are unsustainable. And God, if we could only retire at 64, we'd be dancing in the streets and not rioting in the streets. But my question is, how do we get to that issue? And anything in your experience lead to that discussion?
You know, that was one of the sad things about Bill Clinton's second term getting tied up with the intern scandal. He had a solid victory in 96, and we had budget surpluses. We were looking at budget surpluses. It was the ideal time to do a transition in entitlement programs, in how they were funded and in how they were paid out, et cetera. Because as you know, and as we know from around the world, whenever you move from one system to another, there are huge transition costs. We had the money. in the late 90s. We had the money to actually pay for transition costs. And yet we did not have, or Bill Clinton did not have, the political capital to do anything like that. So we were stuck and we missed that moment. I mean, we missed that moment in history. Sure. And so now, you know, the other moment in history was, I think, 1983, when Reagan and Tip O'Neill basically did an entitlement reform package. It was very quietly done. It was done for future generations. And yet it bought us some important time in terms of the soundness of the system. So those are sort of the two ways to do it. We're not going to have surpluses anytime soon. And unfortunately, we don't have the kind of working relationship between a Speaker of the House and a President of the United States that could do a grand deal, a grand bargain. And, you know, I mean, the interesting thing about that 1983 deal was I was much younger then, and it affected me, but I had no idea really what was in it. I mean, and I was a political science graduate student. I mean, I had no idea. And because one of the ways to fix the system is you do it in the out years. You obviously have to make people who are in the system. You can't mess with them, but you can in fact make very incremental changes. And what's always struck me about Social Security particularly is how very small changes have gargantuan budget effects.
A lot of leverage there.
Yeah, it really is a lot of leverage there. So again, if you had a normal political system where you were able to negotiate, this is very doable. But we haven't had that for a long time.
Yeah, I thought George W. Bush also missed an opportunity in the beginning of his second term, maybe changing the investment structure of Social Security so it would be more productive than simply being in Treasury bonds. But the way he presented it did not include the other party. It was kind of a surprise bomb drop, and therefore it went nowhere.
The other thing that happened to Bush, remember, is that whatever political capital he got from winning in 2004, he lost with Hurricane Katrina. Katrina happened then in September of his first term. So he didn't have nearly the political capital he needed to do this. And I will tell you, because of course I worked for Al Gore and we looked at this very, very closely, the bottom line to any privatization of Social Security, the bottom line is, as they say in Texas, that dog don't hunt. It just doesn't work. The reason it doesn't work is that any drop in the market that would affect a generation of retirees, the political will and strength to have Congress step in and make them whole would be overwhelming. And so it's kind of a dream.
I guess the same could be said for means testing, too. I mean, there are billionaires on Social Security, and they're entitled to it because the law says so, and sure. Medicare and so on.
With the billionaires, I mean, there are very small adjustments that could be made that they wouldn't even notice. So changes in the way you calculate cost of living for seniors with, you know, millions of dollars in assets, they wouldn't notice. They're not living on their Social Security. So I think there is a more fertile ground than privatization.
So nothing can happen then in the short term. I guess it's kind of the mystery then of what will make people want to cooperate with one another. And I don't think either one of us knows the answer to that question.
That's right. I mean, this is one place where you really need both parties doing good faith negotiations. And it's not as if there aren't answers. There are plenty of answers. There's plenty of ways to tackle this. But the political will in this day and age is just not there.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. David Wilson, president of Morgan State University. David has had a fascinating career and has garnered a long record of accomplishments from more than 30 years of experience in higher education administration. Came to Morgan State in 2010 from the University of Wisconsin, where he was chancellor of both the University of Wisconsin Colleges and the University of Wisconsin Extension. Before that, he held numerous other administrative posts in academia, including vice president for the University of Outreach, associate provost at Auburn University, and associate provost of Rutgers. And when we were talking earlier, too, you had just mentioned that you had a wonderful nomination at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And David, thank you so much for joining me.
Shane, it is indeed a pleasure to be invited into this conversation with you.
It's not in your in the short bio here, but I also know you served in some capacity in the Obama administration.
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact. As I was leaving the University of Wisconsin, where I oversaw the UW colleges, I accepted the presidency at Morgan. And on my way into the presidency at Morgan in 2010, my name was advanced to President Obama to be considered as a member of his board of advisors on historically black colleges and universities. And so I accepted and served there for 8 years during his two terms.
Amazing. You've had a fascinating career at numerous universities across the U.S. How did you become passionate about the education field, and what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned?
First of all, I was made aware of a quote by Horace Mann, who was a great 19th century educator who really gave rise to public education in the United States. And he was the first to utter the phrase that education is the great equalizer. And why that resonated with me was because I grew up in abject poverty in rural Alabama, and there was no law in Alabama as I was growing up that required black kids to go to school. I was kind of shut off from formal education on a consistent basis. I didn't get a chance to go to school full time until I was in the seventh grade. We lived on property there that were owned by the white landowners. And so the owner of the property, a white woman, would bring down to this little shanty that we lived in, and she would bring Look and Life magazines. My mom, she would make us as children plaster these pages of Look and Life magazines against the wall of this little shanty to keep the cold wind out. I would take a kerosene lamp and go around the walls reading those articles in Look and Life magazines, which is when I first came across the phrase of Horace Mann. From that point on, I committed myself, to education.
It's an amazing story. And two things occur to me. One, it's almost incomprehensible that this happened during our lifetime. That to me is almost shocking. It's also truly inspiring that you recognized that you could do more and sought out to do that and were successful at it. So when you think back on that experience, how has that informed, shaped, influenced your leadership position now as president of Morgan State? It had to have had an impact, but how would you articulate that?
So if you go back to that Alabama environment, what I saw, it was just so many people, my own brothers and sisters, who were 10 times smarter than I was. But my first five brothers were illiterate. They never got an opportunity to show the nation how brilliant they were. Therefore, I really took on this whole notion that my life had to be about ensuring that individuals who were drowning in potential and they didn't realize it would be in a position where they would realize it. I was never, ever about positions that would enable me simply to replicate privilege. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care what type of family you came from. I think that's where sometimes we kind of get education wrong. We have institutions that want to define themselves based on how many students they don't admit. I'm about just the opposite, taking individuals who are absolutely stellar and don't realize it and bringing that into existence for them.
You've had so many opportunities that you could do other things, perhaps at larger organizations, but you're where you want to be on purpose, by design, for the kinds of reasons you just talked about, that it's fulfilling. But can you talk a little bit more about that?
There have been so many so-called top 50 institutions in the United States that have come aggressively after me. And, I flirted with a couple of them, and I went home to Alabama because these two were very serious. And my family is brutally honest with me, and they keep me grounded. So I flew down and began to talk with them about these institutions that were coming after me, I was thinking they would be impressed. And when I finished, my youngest sister said to me, "Now, are you finished? Clearly, we are not understanding why you would even consider leaving Morgan." It just reassured me that I'm living my purpose at Morgan. And it is joyful to be at a place where you want to be versus being at a place where others think you should be.
One question that I always have to ask, is there one leader or maybe a couple of leaders that have inspired you, that have, you mentioned Horace Mann, I don't know if that fits in this category, but what might be a couple of leaders that you remember that inspired you, that gave you purpose, helped shape your life?
In 1989, when I was selected as a W.K. Kellogg Fellow, we had to be introduced to leadership that was different in a lot of ways than the leadership that we had been exposed to. In February of 1990, Mr. Nelson Mandela was released. And that's where I wanted to go and meet Mr. Mandela. We had no idea that he would grant an audience, and he did. He granted an audience, and Mr. Walter Sisulu did as well. So here I am, having grown up in Alabama, I harbored some anger toward the society there that kept me from realizing my potential and then kept so many others like me from ever realizing their potential. At the end of a conversation that we had, someone asked Mr. Sisulu, "We're leaving this conversation thinking that you harbor no anger towards a society that locked you away for 27 years. Are we leaving with the correct conclusion?" He said, "I harbored no anger or bitterness towards a society that locked me away for all of those years because I and others like me knew that what we were doing was the right thing. If you commit yourself to doing the right thing, there should never, ever be any space in your heart for anger or bitterness." And that was transformational for me and why I respect and admire Mr. Nelson Mandela and Mr. Walter Sisulu today.
That is a great story. And it, you know, with all the accomplishments through your life, I'm sure it had a great impact on your ability to go as far as you have, and you're still going.
Well, I have a takeaway in terms of leadership lessons I've learned. We would be well served as a nation if I think we created these opportunities for young people at various stages to really, first of all, see the United States. And then we need that same opportunity globally. As a result, when you do that, you understand the history over here. You understand the culture over here. You understand, and you got to understand the world beyond an intellectual understanding. You want to think of your maturation in a way where your brain can never, ever, ever be hacked. So that's sort of the way that I kind of see all of that.
That's brilliant. And being born in rural Southwest Kansas, flyover country, as they say, I can tell you that your comments about travel and getting out, not just reading about it, but actually traveling, it really is important. It's absolutely critical for someone's personal development.
I happen to think so.
Well, Dr. David Wilson, thank you so much. I love every single piece of today, but also your life story. It's really impressive, inspiring, and thank you for sharing it.
Shane, thank you very much for inviting me to have this conversation with you again.
And I'm Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. We'll see you next time on the Lessons in Leadership podcast.